Hey, this is Brett Weiss, retro gaming YouTuber and author of many books. You are listening to Scene World Podcast. It is totally awesome.
Hey, it's the Scene World Podcast. My name is AJ. That's Yuri over there. I'm on the wrong machine today, but that doesn't matter.
Right.
In a minute, we'll be talking to John Romero, the guy that made Doom and a lot of other things, lots and lots of other things. But we'll be talking about his book, The Doom Guy, which is out now.
Out since a year, actually.
It's been out. Yeah, it's been out for a bit. Yeah. But we're still going to talk about that. So that's in a second. Before that, though, we've got a little bit of news, I suppose, we can deal with.
Right. Well, I mean, I actually got a couple of news. I mean, also some not so much news, but anyway, worth mentioning, because unfortunately, perhaps on the sad side, Mike Begum, Prolylex, a competitive Street Fighter esports player. Unfortunately, he died in March at the age of 35. The cause of his death is not disclosed, so nobody knows. But what is noteworthy, and that is why I decided to put it in, that Amazon.com recently delisted his book.
Oh.
Yeah. So his book, My Life Beyond the Floor, where he talks about being handicapped and becoming a pro esports player and so on, is available anywhere else except America.
What was his what was the handicap that he's talking about?
Let me see if I can find a good explanation. Yes, well,
what's his name again?
Mike Begum. And he had arthrochroposis, a rare genetic condition that affected the movement of the joints in his arms and legs.
We tried to talk to him early on. Well, back in the early days when we had like the frag dolls and stuff like that, he was on our short list, and we communicated with him a few times about having him on, and it just didn't work out for some reason, right?
No, that's not true. I only emailed him once asking him if he would still have some copy left of his book. Some physical copy, but he said, like, no, it's all sold out. But we never spoke to him about being a guest on the podcast.
However, you are
remembering it wrong.
Maybe we talked about having him as a guest on the podcast, but we didn't move beyond that.
Perhaps, yeah. Anyway, the noteworthy thing here is, for whatever reason, the book is now delisted from Amazon.com, so you can't even get the Kindle version. It's just that the item's not currently available for purchase, but you can get it anywhere else. So I had a look at all the Amazon pages where you still can get it from, and the list is as follows: Amazon Germany, Amazon Brazil, Amazon UK, Amazon Spain, Amazon France, Amazon India, Amazon Australia, and Amazon Canada. Mm-hmm. Any other Amazons I didn't mention here don't have the book listed.
Okay.
So it's weird why they would unlist a digital book, because it's not really like a Kindle book is limited in amounts, you know, it's digital after all.
Yeah, I do remember he came up quite a bit when we were talking to Able Gamers back in the day.
True.
Yeah, that was one of way back when we volunteered for both Extra Life
but that wasn't,
and Able
that
Gamers.
That wasn't Able Gamers, actually. That was the other one.
Extra Life?
Before. Extra Life, exactly. We never spoke to Able Gamers.
Are you sure about that?
We only spoke to Extra Life, but we never spoke to Able Gamers.
Because we volunteered for Able Gamers. We were on that.
Yes, that is because Rick Heaton worked for them for like two weeks.
That's right.
After he was let go because they figured they cannot pay him his salary anymore. Right, so he was only there for a very short amount of time. But we never actually talked to Able Gamers themselves.
Right. That's when we talked to Rick Heaton, maybe. Or maybe after. No, it was after that because he was still with Extra Life at the time.
Exactly. But it's a good idea. We could invite Able Gamers, whoever is doing the PR right now for them, perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah, because we volunteered for, like, I think it was like a year we did something. We did the event. And then after that, we didn't anymore because it's really hard to kind of keep up. We tried to do that with Extra Life as well and just kind of, you know.
Yeah, we stopped doing it because your dog died during the live stream.
We stopped doing that the 1 year because that was 2018.
But we never resumed after that.
We did not.
Exactly. But I mean, nowadays we are doing so much other stuff.
Yeah.
We never kept going on with the live streaming after all. So anyway, I don't know what the reason behind is that the digital version of the book is no longer sold in the U.S.
Neither do I, but yeah, I mean, that's...
But if you are somewhere else that isn't in the U.S., I highly recommend getting the book, even though it's only available in the Kindle version. Mm-hmm. And I mean, theoretically, many of those Amazon localization shops I just mentioned actually have the option to switch the interface to English. Like at Amazon Germany, you can just say switch to English, and right. Then you could buy the book from another Amazon store that isn't the US.
Right.
However, perhaps you might not be able to put it on your Kindle because your Kindle account is an American one and not a German one or whatever.
Well,
from wherever you bought it from. But at least you could read it from the Windows app, for example, or somewhere else that isn't a physical Kindle. Anyway, I thought it was worth mentioning because it's a unique person, a unique esports player, and he was very successful, especially with Zhongli. That was his go-to character, and he was on the top of his game. So the story is worth to be preserved, that is something we do a lot here at SceneWorld. What do you want? We want to add something?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, I thought I would mention it because I find it pretty strange that such an important book, at least for people like us, would be removed from the Amazon store. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody must have intervened and say we don't want this to be sold anymore in the U.S. for whatever reason. You know. It's interesting, and I will link to that as well. He even has been working with Capcom themselves for the official promo of the book when it has been released in 2014. So exactly 10 years ago, the book was released originally, and he even got a promo deal with Capcom. Quite huge, you know?
Yeah.
So Capcom made the promo video for the book. Yeah. I didn't read the book yet. I just bought it like last week.
Right.
When I learned that it has been delisted from American stores, I was like, I want to get it before it gets removed from Germany as well.
Mm.
All right. Other news. System 3 is running a crowdfunder on Kickstarter. The Last Ninja Collection, and bonus games for various systems like Xbox, PS, Switch, and PC. And yeah. And we reported a few episodes down, we reported Test Drive Unlimited Solar Crown having been released. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, after the release of the game, the developer Kaolon actually went on strike for the third time.
Okay.
Because of working conditions and stuff. So that's quite interesting. And also, after many, many years with due to license issues, the game Classic Racer Elite has finally been released for PC via Steam. It okay. has been released on other consoles like the Switch, like a few years back, but due to license issue, the PC release was delayed for a few years. And now it finally has been released. And also, here's something positive about living in the EU compared to America. Because in the EU, as you might know or not know, the EU has forced Apple to make third-party stores possible on the iPhone and iPad. And the first company to take use of that is Epic. So now Epic has their store exclusive in the EU to play Fortnite and other games again on my iPhone. And of course, I was one of the first people to install Fortnite on my iPhone again, because now I can, because I'm living in the EU. And for those people who don't know, because we discussed it a lot of times, EU is not equal to European continent.
No.
Norway is not part of the EU. Switzerland, not part of the EU, right? So, dear Americans, if you sell something to the EU, don't sell it over UK, Norway, or Switzerland, because it doesn't give a difference if we are shipping it from America or from non-EU European countries.
Right, right. So, who is somebody just recently, was it Finland maybe, that just joined the EU?
Largely they joined the NATO.
Oh, NATO, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
NATO is something different.
Yeah.
Don't confuse the NATO with the EU, please. That was NATO.
Right, right, right.
And they called it the NATO East expansion.
Right.
Because it would expand to East Europe. And as we know, the Ukraine was also in negotiations.
Wait. Are you saying? Never mind. I'm just.
Well, what's wrong?
Looking at something else. Oh, Finland is a member of the EU.
Yes. But it wasn't part of the NATO.
Right.
Of the military.
Yeah. So it's now what I. Yeah.
The country that isn't part of the EU but is in Scandinavia is Norway. That's the one you're looking for. But right, Sweden, yeah. Denmark, and Finland are all three in the European Union.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What is different, though, that Denmark and Sweden, despite being in the European Union, they don't have the euro as a currency, because they said, we don't want that. So that is why you have Danish crowns and Swedish crowns in those countries still. Okay. Not the euro.
Okay, then.
Yeah. Right. That's it, yeah. And the reason why Finland just joined the NATO was because they are fearing attacks from a certain aggressor.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that Russia made moves on Ukraine to begin with was because Russia isn't allowed to join NATO. You know, when NATO kind of popped up, because the U.S. wanted to have such a big power thing, they were like, "Yeah, no, none of that crap, Putin." Russia wants a buffer between them and the NATO states, and normally there would be kind of a puppet president installed in Ukraine and whatever else, and that's how it was for a long time. But then Zelensky is not like that, and the overwhelming population of Ukraine wants to join NATO, and so Zelensky was pushing that forward, and Russia was like, "No, we don't like that," and jumped in there to try to stop that. I'm not defending Russia's thing. They shouldn't be messing around with that at all. But yeah, Finland also shares a border with Russia. They're not a member of NATO, and Russia has kind of, you know, done some, weight hefting, throwing their weight around up there to try to prevent them from joining.
Exactly. And it was actually, interestingly, Hungary who was actually against it. Because Viktor Orban is not a very democratic president himself.
Ooh, correct, yes.
Anyway. So this is a short insight into worldwide politics.
Yeah.
What I wanted to say is, if you are in the EU, you can now play Rocket League, Fortnite, Fall Guys, and all those other epic games that have been removed from the Apple Store because Epic didn't like they had to pay 30% of their revenue to Apple because they consider it too much. Yeah, anyway. Other news? A Minecraft movie is coming April next year.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Jack Black is one of the main actors in the game.
Yep.
I'm not really
into the games. I see a lot of people shitting on it for some of the cast choices. I don't care who's in it. I'm not going to poo-poo anyone's thing. Anyway, I just don't have any, game translations don't really. Yeah. I didn't watch the new Mario thing with, what's his name? I can't think of what the guy's name is. The newer.
Chris
Pratt?
Exactly.
Pratt, yeah.
That was his name.
Yeah. Not Charles Martinet.
No, he stepped down as being
as
being the voice of Mario Luigi and now he is a brand ambassador.
Yeah, or my voice of Mario, Captain Lou Albano.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, well, anyway, another news I've got, there is actually a fan remake being done of Wing Commander 1 in Unity.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that, yeah.
Which is interesting because since a year everybody's shitting on Unity. And now somebody is redoing a Wing Commander 1 for Unity. Yeah.
Wing Commander is one of those games that I wish I loved. So let me give you a little bit. It's an Origin Systems game, okay? A long time ago, I played Space Rogue on the C64. That's also an Origin game. That game kicked ass. That's probably one of my top three games ever is Space Rogue. And not the one, if you look up Space Rogue, you'll find like a kind of a dungeon crawly game. That's not what it was. It was like a 3D space flight role playing thing. It was like five different games pushed into one. It was really cool. Then Wing Commander came out and kind of took a lot of the things that made good, they kind of melded that in because it was sort of some of the same people doing it.
Chris Roberts.
Yeah. Right, right. So my Wing Commander started with Wing Commander 3, I believe, on PlayStation, with the live action, you know, Mark Hamill, dudes in cat suits and stuff. You know, that's where I kind of stepped into Wing Commander, and I was like, you know, that was amazing. But I always wanted to play the earlier ones. And so finally, when I got my Amiga, one of the first things I did was get Wing Commander, and it sucked. It was...
Well, I mean, it was slow and sluggish because the computer was not very capable of...
The computer was capable of a lot more than this. The Wing Commander on the Amiga is pretty much a one-to-one conversion of the DOS version. Because I had played the DOS version briefly, and I couldn't get into it. So I figured this would be better. And again, it's a DOS conversion. I'm like, come on, the Amiga can do so much better than this. The music, the audio, or they could have even done, you know, I've got an accelerator on this thing, like Elite, in Elite 2 and whatnot on the Amiga. They make full use of that accelerator. You know, I put Elite 2 on this thing, and that you watch the intro, and it's like, it's fast, and it's awesome.
It's Wing Commander does not. It's actually not called Elite 2.
Yeah, I know it's called Frontier or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Frontier Elite 2.
Frontier Elite 2.
Oh, sorry.
2.
Elite Dane. Yeah. Elite 2. Yeah.
Frontier Elite 2. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. If you play that on here, you know, one of the intro to that game is kind of a sort of a benchmark almost to show how fast the computer is. And it plays great on here. But Wing Commander does not make use of that at all. You play Wing Commander on my accelerated Amiga, it runs just as slow as if it was on a stock Amiga 500. So. Yeah, so it was not a great conversion, and people may disagree with me that grew up with it, and that's fine. I'm not gonna tell you you're wrong, but for me, I was not a fan. It's interesting you talk about a remake of games because I've got one here that baffles me. There is available on itch.io. It is a remake. I guess it's a Windows remake, that's what it looks like, of the Atari 2600 version of E.T. Now, why you would remake E.T., which was not a fantastic game.
Which is actually considered the worst game of all time,
I wouldn't call it the worst game of all time. A lot of people blame it for the video game crash, but that was happening either way. They just made a lot of them in anticipation of it.
Only in the US, by the way. That's also something that people forget about.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, it's but I'm looking at it, and again, I don't want to poo-poo anyone's. If somebody worked hard on this, and that's great. I'm not going to poo-poo anyone's desire to do that. But the graphics looked like they were done in Microsoft Paint. Which is a style. I'm not, again, you know, that's mine aren't very better. Mine aren't much better at this point. I used to be pretty good at graphics, but now, that's available on itch.io. It's a name your own price game. So I encourage everyone, if you download it, to name yourself a good price, like a real price. Don't just download it for nothing. That's not cool at all. Because again, someone worked hard on this. In releasing stuff, Core i64 has got the finalized production boards for the FD series drives. Or no, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, the HD. Yeah, no, the Commodore, the HD series drives, right? The hard drives. Got confused there for a second. Yeah, the HD 4000 is, or HD 40? Yes, the HD 40. Or HD 4000. No, it said HD 4000 on the board. I don't know. But so they've got the production boards. And if anyone's not following along at home, Core i64 is starting to make the old Commodore, or the old CMD hard drives that were around way back in the 90s and that were awesome drives. But I think it's more of a build your own, like you can get the board, the motherboard for it, and they can sell you the plans to make a 3D case. I don't know if they're going to be doing that or not.
Mm.
And the boards are fully socketed, made by PCBWay. I mean, they got to sponsor us, by the way. They sponsor everybody else.
Yeah, we never pulled through with this idea of moving it to your place.
Yeah,
but you
yeah,
said you would get some info, but you didn't get you didn't give me any info about that yet. So I'm still waiting for you to give me the info on that.
We'll work on that.
Perhaps also, we should. Perhaps we should. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, in stuff coming out, I guess a lot of this stuff was ready before, but they kind of held back on announcing it because of the VCF Midwest thing that was a couple of weeks back.
Month even.
Yes. Yeah. But the product, the products available for the Commander X16, which is Dave Murray's the Epic Guys thing, that has been released. So there's a MIDI card available for it. There's a serial and Wi-Fi card.
But we mentioned that already. Do we really want
to mention it again? We don't mention that. We mentioned somebody else was making a Wi-Fi card.
Now he's doing his own stuff.
Right, okay. Right. Yeah, somebody else was making that because they deemed that a lacking. Something it lacked was a network card. So they made one. There's also an AM/FM shortwave radio card. That you can have for
which doesn't make much sense because many countries like Germany will have analog radio disabled in a couple of years.
Yeah, yeah.
So it might be useless after a bit.
Oh, well, yeah. A couple of new games are out, and they've announced that they've sold about 1,100 units. That's pretty decent for that. So that's out. There's a couple of demos for it. There's a couple of games coming out. Asteroids and I'm looking here. Manic Miner, which is a port of the Spectrum game, Pac-Man, Petsky Robots, of course. They've got a bunch of the Infocom games like Zork and whatnot. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff coming out for it now. So if you were on the fence, now is the time to get one.
Nice.
I'm curious. I'm really curious to know how many. So these have sold about 1,100 units. I'm curious to know how many Commodore or Mega 65s have been sold comparatively, because these were both kind of like the cool machine that was, cutting edge, sort of like the next generation 8-bit machine that never really kind of was made. And the Mega 65 has been out for a bit now, and you know, people are still buying it. I don't know how many people are buying it. And again, I don't know how many. It's not like this where there's actually software being made for the X16. I don't know what was made for the 65. I think a lot of people just use it in 64 mode.
Probably.
Yeah. Or if they use it at all. I mean, I haven't seen anyone really rocking the Mega 65. Aside from here's my Mega 65. I'll put it back in the box now, you know.
Anyway, I have one last bit of news, and that is that on the 21st of September, so 2 days ago, Broken Sword Shadow of the Templar Reforged has been released. And that's interesting because it's the original point-and-click adventure from 97. 96. And they used AI to, reforge and redo the whole game.
Right.
So
yeah,
better graphics and so on. And that's quite interesting because Polygraph made actually an interview with Charles Saltic, the founder of the studio, a year ago. And he mentioned that Revolution only consists of 8 people right now, and without AI, despite being a Kickstarter product, so crowdfunded, he wouldn't have the people or the resources to make it happen even. So it's a positive example how AI can actually help projects to get off, to go off the ground without actually, you know, costing people's job. Right, in this right. case, it even helped preserving the jobs of those 8 people from this very, very tiny developer studio. Because there are not many traditional studios around with just 8 people, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and probably you have seen it in the last weeks, and we will continue doing that. We every 1 or 2 days, we slowly released our Gamescom interviews. And right. AJ will actually work on one in a bit as well. And there should be 2 more, and then we are through with that. Mm-hmm. So watch our space for more. And if you like it, subscribe to our YouTube channel because that's free. Yeah, and get the bell notification, obviously. So yeah. That would be all from my side.
Yep, I got nothing else.
Wonderful. So now let's jump to Ireland and talk to John Romero and how it was to be a book author for once and how well it was perceived now 1 year later. Bye-bye. Today we have another guest, and today we actually have a returning guest, and this is the one and only John Romero, also called Doom Guy. And I have been talking to you 5 years ago about the history of your career and so on, the historical interview, and now welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks.
Awesome. You're welcome. Yeah, and today we actually want to primarily talk about your book that you actually already released a year ago, which is Doom Guy Life in First Person. And interestingly, I saw some Instagram posts of you a month ago while I was at Gamescom that you have been at the publishing house visiting them, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we just went to New York recently. And while we were there, we went and visited our publisher, Abrams Books.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, so perhaps let's talk a bit about how did you get the idea of making your book and talking about your life? I mean, there have been books about you before, and I've read that actually was the reason why you didn't want to make your own book for many years, because you said, like, there is already a book by somebody else, why I should write my own, right?
Yeah. Yeah, what happened was I was at a conference, and I basically was asked to give a talk about my life, and, you know, it was about my life, like, who's the person who made the games everyone already knows about. When I gave the talk, there were people who were kind of shocked at the beginning of it. And because none of that information I'd ever done in a conference before. So somebody said, wow, you need to write a book. Like nobody, we didn't know any of this stuff. And so that kind of like, that just that idea was, oh, that's, yeah, maybe I'll think about that. Might be a good time sometime in the future, because this was like 6 years ago or something like that, at least 6 years.
So the idea already grew when we talked the last time. Of course, you couldn't say that because it was still secret, I guess.
Yeah, like everything.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, interestingly, I looked at your store and I was a bit surprised. You translated the book in zillion languages, including Russian, which is mm-hmm. actually something most people in the video game industry right now avoid. So I wonder, what was the decision taking that you say, I support the Russian market anyway, in a way?
Basically, you know, there are companies that are interested in doing this. You know, they come to us and they say, can we please do this work? Well, you know, we'll do all the work for you. they do everything. They publish it even in the country. So all we have to do is say, yes, you can do that. So there's really no effort on our side. And I know a bunch of Russian game developers, and you know they're not the ones responsible for what's happening over there. They're people who want to learn how to make games, or they want to learn, you know, what the history of these games was all about. And you know, I don't think it's not actively supporting the country. It's trying to support developers. So if it was tied in any way to the government, I wouldn't have done that.
I also wonder, in another interview you mentioned, it was actually surprising, this conference that you mentioned, because people were not only just reducing you to having released Doom, because everybody knows that story, you know? So how is it for you to write something that is about your life, basically, and not this one single game, which is actually very, very limiting, because you also did Wolfenstein 3D, right? So you did other stuff as well, and not only this one game.
About 180 games, actually.
You see?
So when you read the book, you'll find out that just in 1991, we made 13 games just in that year. I've been making games since 1979. So anytime you have a really big game that's a hit, like Minecraft or anything like that, there's many, many years and many games that came before that overnight success. So, yeah, by the time we even created id Software, three of the four of us were already experts. We'd been making games for 10 years already at that time. So we, you know, so it's like putting together a group of people that are, you know, super senior. We know everything. We've made lots of games individually, and now we're going to make games together, which was basically for the first time. Like, games weren't made in groups before that time much. I mean, some were really rare to find a game even that was made by a team before that time. But that was kind of the time to start getting teams together. And so that's why our games were such huge successes, is finally coming together and putting on all of our collective efforts to work on one thing.
Actually true. I mean, before the time, yeah.
Kind of the birth of the kind of AAA type of game that there is now, where it's like a huge groups of people working together. Because, yeah, like you said, it wasn't really a thing that happened much. You'd get sometimes, you know, with big companies like Electronic Arts, you'd have like a three-person team or something, you know, graphics, music, and code. But usually, like having an army of people, or like a real group doing it, wasn't common until the late 90s, right? Mid-90s, was that?
Yeah. Probably mid, maybe starting in the mid-90s. I remember when Dark Forces was about to come out, I found out that at LucasArts, they had multiple disciplines involved in just the level design, where somebody did the level design, like level designer, then someone came in and they textured it. So an artist came in, an environmental artist came in and did the texturing. Somebody else, I believe, did the placement of all the ammo and the weapons and pick, you know, health, all the pickup items. And someone else may have done the lighting. So they had like several people involved, where at that exact time, one person did everything in a map.
right.
Even at that point. So it's like LucasArts was the first time I heard of like a bunch of people piling on, even just in one area. Even early LucasArts games were made by very few people, you know?
Right. Yeah. You usually see, like, you know, Monkey Island and stuff, you get the credits. And it's, you know, like code, some graphics, music.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. Yeah. The longest part would actually be the conversion to other systems.
Yeah. That you have a whole group of, you know, like Eastern European folks working on the conversions.
Right. But there have been examples before. I mean, one of the most classical examples would probably be Summer Games by Epix. That is actually also the reason why the the different disciplines have different graphic styles because different group of people actually worked.
They were making different games, weren't they? They stapled together like 8 different games to make one game. So that I don't think that counts.
Yeah, awesome. I thought you were talking about just the ports. Because ports are, like, even at Origin, when they did a port, it was usually one person did the port. And it depended on what the computer was, who did it. Because someone was like, Dr. Cat is the Commodore 64 guru. He's the one who ports those. And, you know, true. And these other people are the gurus of the Mac or whatever, true, right, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, it led to some not so very good conversions. I just remember Turrican on the NES. Manfred Trenz wasn't good in doing music, to be honest.
Well, it depends on how fast they do it. And it depends on how good that person is, like how much they know about it. It could have been that person was really good on a different system and they just needed that person to hurry up and get a port done
exactly
on a different system. Like as an example, Wolfenstein 3D for the Super Nintendo. That was a port that we were having somebody else work on until we found out, you know, that they weren't working on it. And now, like 8-9 months later, they didn't do anything. Wow. So we needed to make that port ourselves, and we had never programmed a Super Nintendo ever. So we needed to learn the hardware. We needed to take all of our data and change it into the format that we could use. And we had to write all the code, too, like to use it on a Super Nintendo. There's audio. It's completely different than what we were doing. And we had to get all of that done, plus all of the get rid of blood, change the dogs to rats. Like everything, we had to do all this work, and luckily we did it in 3 weeks.
Yeah, I was gonna say because you had to change a lot of stuff because Nintendo didn't want the gore and stuff.
Yeah,
so you actually had to make new assets for it.
Family friendly version of Doom.
Ooh. Yeah,
it was Wolfenstein.
Yeah,
it was Super Nintendo. We were making Doom, and we had to stop making Doom to do the Wolfenstein Super Nintendo port. Mm. So that's why we got it done so fast, because we needed to get back to Doom. So we got it done in 3 weeks.
Yeah. In the comments, actually, somebody wrote from the interview 5 years ago, I should have asked you about your opinion about the current state of the video game industry.
Well,
about what's going on right now?
What part of it? There's a lot of different things going on.
I mean the scene really changed a lot. I mean, just recently, for example, the YouTuber Modern Vintage Gamer made a video saying Doom didn't kill the Amiga. It was actually Wolfenstein 3D that did. So at some point, history is challenged, actually, because
there's books out there saying Doom is the one that killed the Amiga, not that Wolfenstein was. I don't think Wolfenstein was a strong enough game to do that.
Either way, you're responsible.
I even have Gloom.
there you go. Yeah, what
shrink
is your
wrap too?
Oh yeah, what's your opinion of the retro gaming scenes, because they're kind of blowing up at the moment, you know, C64 or, you know, vintage PC or, you know, the old Amiga, Atari and stuff. They're kind of exploding. You know, I just realized that we've got something in common, that we were both published by Softdisk. You quite a bit more than me, but
yeah. What did you publish on Softdisk?
A couple of games and a bunch of reviews, I believe. Yeah.
Was it Apple II?
No, it was the Commodore, Lodestar, the Commodore magazine.
Oh, you worked with Fender.
Yes. Fender and Jeff.
That's cool. Yeah. You know what's funny? I have a story about that. They were in the room next to us. So when I was doing the Gamer's Edge disc, which is me and Carmack and Tom, the office right next to ours is where Fender and Jeff were at. And one day, like, I didn't go in there that much because we're like so busy doing our stuff. They're busy doing their stuff. I happened to walk by and they had an author in there. And you know how authors they would send in their programs, and then they would determine internally whether it's worth finishing or whether they should just forget it, because it's gonna take too long to get it to like professional level to publish. Mm-hmm. And one of the people contributing was actually in the office because they wanted to publish this person's stuff, but they just needed them to fix a bug in their code, and they couldn't fix it. So they asked this person to come in, and when the person came in there, the program was basically for loop with a bunch of data statements, because it was all assembly language. It was all like the numbers for assembly and data statements.
Yeah, yeah.
This guy jumped into the data statements and was editing data statements.
Oof. Oh, good Lord.
Unless you know what it's like programming in machine code,
yeah.
this is like nuts what this person did. I've never seen anyone do this before.
that's some skill there. Yeah, I was they were great. I loved Fender and Jeff. I was a kid when I first submitted stuff, and wow. They were like, they send it back and they're like, you know, it needs a little bit more polish. So I do something, send it back in. Like the third or fourth time, Fender's like, okay, we'll buy it. Just stop.
Nice. Yeah, because sometimes they'll just finish it.
Yeah, right.
You know, if they know like the turnaround time is getting too close to the deadline, they just get it and they just go do it if they need to do anything to it. But yeah, it was really fun working there.
I can imagine. Yeah. It was seemed like a great culture.
It was. It was. Mm.
Awesome, awesome. Is that also part of the book? Because interestingly, when I ordered my copy of the book, you had a little field there, a little text field asking what is the most you're looking forward to read in my book? And I was like, why is he asking that? Is he secretly planning a successor book with all the contents people are missing from the first book or something like that?
Yeah, when you finish the book, you can see it's not the end. Like, I'm making a huge first-person shooter right now. That's not in the book.
Nice. Okay.
So, yeah, maybe there'll be a part two.
Volume two, yes.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, awesome. Volume two.
Awesome. So it's like Back to the Future to be continued, kind of.
Yeah.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah. I mean, I've heard about that you are working on another first person shooter, but you also said it's secret. You cannot say any word about it.
Yeah. Except it's a shooter. It's being made in Unreal 5, and we have a big publisher behind it.
Exactly. That's the one you emphasized on. You're very happy about the publisher you will be getting. So.
Yeah.
I mean, you are John Romero, right? You enter the room and anybody would publish your stuff, no?
It's actually not that easy, you know? If you're going to get a game published nowadays, you need a demo. And if you don't have a demo, it's really hard to sell. So making a demo is really important. So for this game, we did that.
Awesome.
Man, even for you. Yeah. You could just be walking in and be like, yo, I'm John Romero, fool.
Boom, yeah.
I mean, I guess game development is a lot different nowadays. I mean, nowadays you have Steam, Epic Store, and so on. You have tons of hardware to support. Everybody is like, is it optimized for NVIDIA or AMD, and so on. And people want features like cloud saving, and if it doesn't, then it's a crap game. And I mean, if I look at comments on Steam, people even don't know sometimes how things are. They are like, what's a DOS game, by the way? I'm like, yeah. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's you kind of have to educate people, you know, because there are games that get negative reviews because there are no updates anymore. And I'm like, it's a Mega Drive port of a game. How many updates do you want to make to a Mega Drive game, you know? So what does this mean for this new first person shooter of yours? Are you adapting to the new technology, or is there also some sparkle of old retro into it, you know, something common for the old-fashioned Doom or Wolfenstein 3D player, for example?
Yeah, that would be revealing information.
Yeah, I mean, there must be something you can reveal. No,
I already did. That's all I can reveal. Those three pieces of information. Everything else is up to the publisher. And when it's time to announce it, then things will be announced. But it's not my job to tell everybody and like ruin the surprise and ruin the initial information that's released.
Okay. Well, at least I tried.
Yeah. What I get to say is what gets people interested in trying to interview with us to get a position.
Awesome. Yeah. What can you say that you look forward to cover in a new book? I mean, now that you had a year to gather some feedback, what did you gather so far from people answering you?
I guess, what has the reception been?
Exactly.
It's been really great, really great. I mean, just open up the book and look at the quotes. You know, like there's quotes on the back if you got hardcover, and on the inside it's on, you know, there's a whole bunch of basically what is it? Forbes called it the best nonfiction book about games ever written. It's right on the cover. Hmm. It's gotten really great feedback, and it's because people they really like the way it was written. They like that I'm really humble, that I'm, you know, that anything that's difficult, I said it, you know, I didn't like shy away from anything. And people find a lot of relatable stories in there that they get excited about, because, you know, they read about like the game dev part, you know, mostly game is all game dev. They read about those parts, they get all fired up wanting to do that, because of the way it's described and how it goes. It makes them want to be a game developer. But I have so many letters from people basically just saying like they cried reading parts of it and were laughing reading parts of it. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that reminds them of their life and everything. And sometimes these games that I made meant a lot to them because it helped them through really tough times, or they remember when they used to play Doom with their dad, who isn't around anymore, you know, on his lap or co-op or deathmatch or whatever. Lots of stories. There's tons and tons of stories for people that, you know, people have gotten married in Doom and Quake and just basically everything. You know, everything that can happen. The game somehow touched people, and the book just reminds them about the game, the making of the game, which is really great. Doom was such a great development process. But like every single one, every game that we made had a really amazing story because so much happened, even during short amounts of time. Even like Commander Keen, just the 3 months that we spent making three games, was a lot of stuff happening.
Actually true. Not a lot of people talk about Commander Keen or Quake. You mentioned it in a by sentence just right now, you know?
Yeah. Yep. I mean, I had a fan visiting the office today. You know, like this is go down the street. It's like, you know, it's really a lot of people love playing those games.
Yeah, they were a staple of a lot of people's youth, I guess. I think youth, because it's like it's mid-90s. I was not a kid anymore, but but people are adults now weren't even born yet, so it's like,
yeah, I know.
Messes me all up. Yeah. When was Quake? Quake was 96. Okay.
June 22nd, 1996. Yeah.
Interesting, because I actually saw Quake before I saw Doom.
Yeah, it happens sometimes. I talked to someone today who saw Commander Keen when he was 4, and that was in 93, and Keen came out in 90.
Yeah.
The order that some people see games in is not always sequential order.
Yeah. Remember they had Quake in the school computer lab? Because there was a network version of that, right? Like Quake Arena.
It was made for the internet.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So they had
Quake
that on.
Was the first game made for the internet.
Yeah. So that was on like all the machines in the school. And when we were supposed to be doing like, you know, lessons, we'd just be playing Quake.
Yep.
Then it was probably like a year or two later that I saw Doom at somebody's house they were playing it.
That's cool.
I mean, those were the times where teachers had no idea about computer. Teachers nowadays they still don't. So.
Well, now for teachers, it's AI.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
True. Awesome. Yeah. Now the question I would like to ask is, I mean, we mentioned it before, the book has been presented in zillion languages. Now the question is it even worth it? I mean, the target group is basically knowing English already, isn't it?
There's a lot of people that like reading those books in those languages. Remember, the people that want to translate it are from that country and they speak that language and they want it translated. It's not our publisher going, put it in Polish. You know, it's like it's a Polish book company going, please, can we translate this to Polish? Because we'll reach a lot of readers. There's a current Spanish language one being done right now. You know, so it's just going to keep boop, just keeps going with Chinese and everything.
I just saw you're missing Portuguese for all the Brazilian Portuguese players. I mean, Brazil has a big gaming scene.
And Portugal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Portuguese, yeah.
Where it came from.
Yep. Yeah.
But still, they are separating their languages because of nuances, I heard.
Yeah. Well, there's Mexican Spanish, there's Spain Spanish, there's Portuguese.
Right. Awesome. Yeah. I mean, perhaps let's mention it a bit. I wonder, how is it, by the way, to be married to Brenda Romero? Because I remember we also had her on the podcast before, and I remember she said in a presentation once where she presented her career in the video game industry that many people say, like, since she's married to you, John Romero's wife, despite she has her own career and even started working in the game industry before you. So perhaps let's tickle that question from your point of view.
What's the question?
I mean, the question is how it is for you. What's your point of view about it? Do you also see that people mostly address you and just see your wife as an attachment? How is it for you personally? I mean, what's your opinion? I mean, I guess it's a fair question to ask because I also asked her the same questions when we interviewed her, how it was for her to be your wife. So now let's turn the question around. How is it for you to be her husband?
Great. I mean, what else? nobody says John Romero's wife. Like that was geez, really long time ago when that meme was going around. There was like GDC presentations and stuff on like people being labeled that way, and so that was just like a thing. You know, a meme of the day 15 years ago, something like that. But yeah, I mean, we're together every day. We work together. We're on calls, many meetings all day long. Yeah, it's great working with her. She's awesome. She's the CEO and the studio director.
I guess she will also have a big part in the upcoming game. Even though you cannot confirm or deny that, I guess.
Can't say anything.
He's just going to keep chiseling away.
Right.
Try to slip one in that nobody catches.
Yeah, I mean, so perhaps let's fine-tune a bit the question I had earlier. What is your opinion about the current gaming scene? Do you follow new takes on history? Like, as I said, the Modern Vintage Gamer video that challenged saying that Wolfenstein 3D was actually...
Well, that's not current. That's a vintage thing that we were talking about, you know?
Yeah, I mean, are you following what people are saying in retro perspective about your creations, or...
I didn't hear about that one.
History.
I didn't hear about the Wolfenstein Amiga thing ever. because all the books were basically all written saying, this is what happened. I was there when this happened. Everyone made the decision to switch.
Okay.
And it was, and it was not one person's idea to say that. It was many, many people. That was the turning point.
So would you say it's not your fault? It was just how the way the technology went and progressed?
Well, I mean, making the game that made that happen, got to take responsibility for that. But the you know, the funny story about this, it's funny because you mentioned Summer Games, which was published by Epics back in the 80s, 84. And what happened in 89, but, you know, Archie McCall, who made the Amiga, right? He's super, super smart, badass. He made the Amiga, and then the Amiga takes off. He then started working on a color handheld console, and he got the hardware working. Is the best color handheld. There wasn't any really before this, so he is making the very first color handheld hardware. Just incredible stuff. He took it to Epics because he had a friend there who basically, you know, he asked him, what can I do with the, how do I get this out there? And his friend there at Epics said, we know Atari, we know the people at Atari, maybe they will make this console and then we can get the exclusive first party development rights to make the games for it, so no one else can be involved in making the very first games for this new console. So they went to Atari, totally worked it out, and that's what became the Atari Lynx. And while they were developing, while Epics was developing the very first games for it, this was basically, they took this on because it was the end for them. Like, this was the last hope that they had of staying as together as a company. And so they didn't have a ton of money. They needed to save money, so they started to cancel contracts that were not as important in the industry to them as, like, new product development stuff, like what they were doing. And they needed all their money on this Lynx development. So one of the contracts they canceled was mine, which was a port that I was doing for, I took a game called Nebulous in Europe, and in the US it's called Tower Toppler. Yep. And I was porting that to the Apple II from the Commodore 64. And that contract got canceled and I was almost finished with it. And it was just like, well, I had co-founded a startup. That was my second game startup. And had been there for, I think, 9 months. I'd already gotten most of Might and Magic 2 ported to the Commodore from the Apple II. And then I started working on this Tower Toppler. And I got almost finished with that port. And this is all within 9 months. And they canceled the contract. And I told my co-founder, like, it was so obvious to me that when that happened, that 8-bit was over. The 8-bit industry was just done, and I needed to move to the PC. So I told my co-founder, look, I will leave, so it's not like a financial burden for me to be in payroll, because we did have like three other games going with people in there, and I needed to just focus on learning the PC. So he said, okay, and I let him just like, you can take all my shares, I'll sign it over, and he keeps the company. And then I left, and I now went to Softdisk. I eventually started software. We eventually make Doom, and it eventually gets RG McHale back for what he did when he canceled those contracts. Like, we got his contracts canceled.
Wow. Okay. I mean,
it's
karma.
I know. Yeah. It's a long thread. It's stupid. We've already joked about this.
I mean, to your defense, for destroying the Amiga gaming market, you know. you did release the source code later on, and it has been ported to the Amiga in 1998. So it did get its official Doom version after all, right?
Yeah. Yeah, people today are so good at programming those old systems. Like, unbelievably, there's there's versions of Doom, I think, for the ZX81.
Yeah.
Like, what? Commodore 64? You know, platforms that in no way in hell could they have done that. But they like to get ingenious with the character sets, you know, to draw really fast, and they limit things, and they make a functional version of Doom on a machine that was never meant to do it.
Which is like funny.
Kind of an ongoing like meme, like does exactly. this machine run Doom?
Exactly.
Everything
yeah,
does.
Yeah, true. But here's the thing. Here's the funny thing. There is a Doom port for the VIC-20, but there isn't a Doom port for the Commodore 64, which is actually a lot better. There's only one that works with the Super CPU, which is basically just a port of the PC code running on the Super CPU, but on the stock hardware, nobody ever made a Doom version. There was even a competition by a British game magazine in the 90s that whoever made Doom would get like £1,000, but nobody ever took on that challenge. So for whatever reason, this system was left out.
Yeah, well, I know it could do it. If you could do it on VIC-20, you could definitely do it on a C64. So it's just somebody just hasn't spent the time doing it. That's
right.
All.
Right. Yeah. I mean, nowadays it's pretty easy, right? I mean, just yourself. If you didn't find a publisher for the new first-person shooter, you could as well go on crowdfunding, Kickstarter, Indiegogo. No.
Yep. But the port, the making the game run on anything less than a PC is far harder than making it run on a pregnancy test or an ATM or a printer or a washing machine or anything. That's easy. It's hard to make a Commodore 64 or VIC-20 or a ZX81 version.
Because you coded on those systems yourself. As you just said, you converted some games in the past. So.
Yeah, but games that were made in 8-bit. Doom is a 32-bit game. It had a DOS extender. It was a big game, and it was made with all kinds of graphic tricks to go at the speed that it went on a PC that was 33 megahertz. We're talking about a 1 megahertz machine at the same res, right? Those old machines' resolutions were basically the VGA 320x200, but on an 8-bit machine. So you have to push the same amount of pixels with 1/33 the megahertz. It's very difficult to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
I remember being amazed at how I had an older Mac for a long time, and I had Doom for that. And I was always amazed at how well it ran, despite the oldness of the machine, because the machine was, you know, much older than that thing. But
what was it, an SE30 or?
No, it was a Quadra 610.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it was the 90s.
Yeah, it was a 68040, but it wasn't like the...
Oh,
like
it was late 80s?
No, it was early 90s. It was early 90s? Towards okay. the crossover to Power PC.
All right. That's cool. Yeah, we developed Doom on Nextstep, which became OS X.
Okay.
So modern Macs are basically running Nextstep, which is the OS we used to make Doom back in the day.
Okay.
In fact, all of the code still has NS underscore in it. In the Mac for Nextstep, all the source code still says NS underscore for Objective-C and all that.
Okay.
Now, speaking about the code, let's perhaps speak about your decision making. Why did you decide to make it open source and release the source code of Doom, actually? What was your decision making process there?
Well, biz-wise, there's just like a lifetime on licensing an engine, and there's a point where it's just not viable anymore because the technology has moved on like two levels. So this was during Quake 3, right? Like, well, actually it was right after Quake 2, and Quake 2 meant that Doom was already two generations old. So when it's two generations old, no, that's ancient history. So why not just give it away? You know, like back then, we owned our own company. We could do whatever we wanted. We published our own games. So we made all the final decisions. And John and I were complete advocates of teach people as much stuff as we can. You know, like And Andre Lamothe, who was a really prolific author of books back then in the 90s, he came to us when he was making his very first graphics book, and we showed him exactly how Wolfenstein's recasting worked, you know. And then he came back again when we were making Doom. We'll teach people whatever, you know, anytime, because giving somebody technical information is not going to devalue our game. And it's really hard to do anything with that tech. It takes a lot of work to even use a piece of kernel of information like that to build a technology or to build a new trick in your game. And then the game that you're making, even if I described the game to you, you would make a different game than I would make. So there's zero reason not to tell somebody something that they need to know, you know?
But it started a flood of Doom clones, I guess.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, any popular game. Look at Minecraft clones all over the place. How many solitaire clones have you seen? How many chess games have you seen? Anything popular is going to have a flood of clones.
I wish more companies would do this because there are so many games from, again, the 8-bit era, the 16-bit era, where publishers are just sitting on the rights. You're not allowed to do anything.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Just was thinking about First Star Software, who are still around and clinching their hands on Boulder Dash. Mm-hmm. You know? So,
right, yeah. First Star, yeah.
Wow, they are even still around anymore, just clinching their hands on Boulder Dash. They are going after people who are actually making projects regarding that. But make sure it's not commercial in any way or sense, because then we are going to sue you and stuff, you know?
Yeah, they're just sitting on it waiting for, like, the apocalypse when we lose all of our infrastructure and end up pulling out these old, like, you know, Ataris and C64s and have to rebuild with them. They're like, we can sell the game then.
Too many new game ideas. Nobody wants that one.
I mean, it's actually true. I mean, look where licenses go nowadays. They are going to iPhones, Android phones, and so on. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, but everybody's looking at shiny new 3D stuff. You know, that was never made into a 3D game. That's ancient history. Right. And that was really like a Super Dig Dug. Really? You know, Dig Dug's one that started that kind of game, you know, that mechanic with dropping rocks and stuff.
Right.
And Mr. Do ripped it off immediately.
That's actually true. Yeah, I mean, so what is your future idea? I mean, now you released your book. Now you said you are doing your first person shooter. You have done everything in your career you could have dream of, right?
I think there's still lots of stuff to do,
really.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Mobi Games, I release stuff every year pretty much. I have things released almost every single year, and you know, it just because you might not have heard about it doesn't mean I'm not making stuff. I'm always making stuff. So I think Mobi Games in the, to 2023 doesn't have something listed, but I know I released something in 2023, so I have to send that update in for what it is. But yeah, there's I'm always making stuff. I love game jams. I'm making games with some of the people from work. You know, they'll come over to my house and we'll game jam and make some cool little indie thing, not released, but just something that is a cool, funny idea or something. Just to, you know, we're all working in this one space and it's fun to get out of that space for a little while and try something else. And so, you know, keep people creatively fulfilled. So we do game jams every once in a while. There are game jams in Galway, you know, the Galway Game Jam, or there's like the Global Game Jam where we'll just do stuff at home, but we might not even pay attention to what the Global Game Jam people are doing. We'll just do our own thing. But it's fun to just make little stuff. You know, there's a site that I put up. It's hilarious. It's called playbarf.com. And that's like any of these little game jammy garbage games that we make, we'll like put those up there. It's been a while since putting one up, but there's one up there that's named July 4th, 1976, And that is a 10-hour game jam game that I made on four platforms.
Wow.
It's a 10-hour game. So it's just me and a coder, and we were there at this one location where all these other game jammers are at. And then it's like 10 o'clock in the morning, boom, go. And we had 10 hours, and at 8 o'clock, everyone stop, and then everybody starts to evaluate everyone's games. It was really, really fun. And I think it's a fun little game. You know, see if you can solve it. It's on playbarf.com.
Good to know. We will link to that. Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Install it. So when are you actually planning to release your next upcoming first person shooter?
Is that nice a
try. Still picking out right. That they're trying to get something.
Okay. So even that is not known yet. Okay.
No,
so
nothing.
So you go by the same quote as Opera Software in the past, when it's done.
Done when it's done. I know exactly when it's done. But that's not for me to tell.
Alrighty. That's pretty nice. Yeah. Awesome. So what we actually learned today still is you are actually considering making a successor book. That means I know what I have to do in the next few weeks, reading that book.
Gotta read that one.
Awesome. Yeah, interestingly, as you mentioned, in a side sentence, sometimes people don't notice what you have done next to Doom. Is that something that disturbs you? Would you like people to more be aware of the other stuff you have done and not just your first-person shooters?
Not really. Yeah, it doesn't matter to me. If they want to go just search with my name, you know, they'll find stuff I've worked on. Moby Games is a great place. Giant Bomb as well. If you're looking for what games I've written, there's a whole bunch of stuff. People can just search there and go look at the links and read about them, and you know, probably just do a Google on the game and go watch a video on YouTube. And I'm still releasing Doom levels, so Sigil and Sigil 2 have been released. Id Software made them part of their distribution, so whenever you buy Doom on Switch or Xbox or anything like that, then it comes with Sigil and Sigil 2.
Yeah, just last week, I guess it was, Bethesda actually released an update to the Steam release of Doom 1 and Doom 2. And it's actually interesting because every time there is a new update to the game at Steam, people are crying about it. Now my old version of the installation is gone, and they changed the engine from DOSBox to something to else.
Yes, Unity now. I agree though with changing it from DOSBox, because no one should be using that to try and run a source port. You know, like source ports are new, you know, updated versions. So I use GZ Doom to make levels. I also do, what is it? Let me see. I have it here. Here it is. This is my pad. Okay. So with my iPad, I use it to sketch level that I'm working on. So you can see, like, there's a sketch of a level.
Oh, nice.
For the upcoming Hellion, which is a Doom 2 level set. It's a 32 levels for Doom 2. Sigil 1 and 2 are both for Doom 1. So basically draw directly on the screen, you know, with the pencil. So I pre-plan the levels, and then I make them in Ultimate Doom Builder. And I twitch them too while I'm making them.
Yeah, just wanted to say, I checked out your YouTube channel a while ago, and you even play levels done by other people, like the
Might
famous
House.
Exactly, yeah. Like,
I know, I need to play it again. I only spent 2 hours and got 5% of the way through it. So,
but still made two parts of it. Yeah, and it's interesting to see the original game designer to be confused about what's going on. Like, oh, they reset the level, you know?
there's a lot of tweaks.
How are you at playing Doom?
I get paid to play Doom, so I wreck everybody.
Okay. Yeah, because I know for a lot of people, and me especially, I suck at things that I make.
Like, most game developers are not good at the games that they make.
Right.
You know, they might be average, but Doom, I played Doom for so long. You know, when I go to speak at conferences, part of the conference is me doing Doom Deathmatch with the crowd. Ooh. So, you know, people in the crowd that have been practicing or whatever, they get the chance to play up on stage, huge screen, heavy metal playing, and then I just play everybody, basically as many people as I can in like an hour, I think it is. So it only takes maybe 5 minutes a game, something like that.
Dang. Wow.
Wow.
We go to 20 frags.
Wow. Awesome. Yeah. Well, before we let you go, by the way, there's also
let's not do that yet. Because there's also the Romero Games site where people can find your stuff.
Yeah. Right? Yep. Or Romero.com.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. So that's tons of merch, tons of, you know, if people want something autographed, then they will send it. You know, they'll buy the autograph on the site, and then they'll send their helmets or whatever it is that they want, signed, and then I'll get it, and I'll sign it, and I'll send it back to them. So that happens a lot. Yeah, but there's a ton of, there's like 100 items on the store. There's lots of shirts, and there's collectible, you know, Doom 2 CDs from the 90s that I have. All kinds of stuff, Hexans, Heretics, you name it.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of stuff on there. There's a head, my head on the stake at the end of Doom 2. It's made in lead, so I have a lead version of those that we sell. I think I have it here somewhere. Let me see. Oh, it's not. It's just in front of my face. I have Doom Guy. I have all kinds of stuff. I have a painting up here that Adrian Carmack painted in 1 hour of a demon with a rabbit, and his stomach is full of rabbits. It's called Bun in the Oven.
That's awesome. Yeah, there's a ton of stuff available on there. So, yeah,
we'll
put a link to that. Yeah, so people can find that.
Awesome. Yeah, so you're
also doing a that mug too. I've got it.
Oh, yeah, you're getting the Baphomet mug.
Good Lord. Yeah. That thing, I'll put it up there so people can see it. That thing is not messing around. Yeesh.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Did you see Catacomb 3D? So the game that basically started texture mapping 3D games before, you know, half a year before Underworld came out. Catacomb 3D were putting out the first big box of Catacomb 3D.
Oh.
So finally, after it was released in November of 1991, and we were finally putting out, 23 years later, we're putting out an official big box release with all kinds of stuff in it.
That's awesome.
Pretty cool.
That's great. Yeah.
Awesome.
It's
awesome.
Even going to be on floppy. It'll be on a floppy disk.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That is sweet.
Yeah, I guess the last time I saw something on floppy disk was 2017 when I received my physical version of Thimbleweed Park by Ron Gilbert.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I finished that game.
And he actually wrote some art assets on the diskette that was enclosed with it, because first I thought, like, wow, it's not a dummy, because you know, nowadays most things are like dummies, you know.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, there's actual data on it, you know.
That's cool.
Wow.
Yeah, my discs we did have very limited sigil releases for like sigil 2 for floppy, a 3.5-inch floppy and a 5.25-inch floppy versions.
Ooh.
Yeah. Oh, and so cool. We had 5.25 is not easy to make. but we put those out and they were gone within a minute. Like, they sold out within a minute.
Wow.
Because we put a limited quantity on those. So Catacomb 3D, you can see that we had have those as well, those floppy versions and everything for people that want to go super old school. And it's cool. They have like holographic labels. Looks pretty cool. But yeah, 5 1/4 inch disc.
Wow. Awesome. I wonder how many people are actually using them. Like as opposed to just getting it for the collectible.
I know. It works. It's got the data on it. You actually have to decompress the data. You like have to copy it off and then, you know, 7 zips. Geez. They have to unzip it because it's actually much bigger than 1.2 megs.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
Awesome.
That's great.
So.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Greetings to Brenda. And I will let you know when we release this, right? Probably in a few days. Will not be along from now. And much success.
Good. Yeah, thanks a lot. You too.
Thank you. Bye bye.
All right, have fun.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye.
Okay.
Whoa. Awesome. To the minute.